It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Tess Vigeland. For almost a century, it's been a tenet of the American dream. Work hard enough and you'll get to rest and relax in your golden years. Travel, volunteer, see the grandchildren. It's a familiar image in TV ads for companies that manage retirement funds.
Your generation is definitely not headed for bingo night. In fact, you could write a book about how you're going to turn retirement upside down.
But retirement as we know it may be consigned to the dustbin of history. According to a new Pew study, Generation X, aged 38 to 47, is on track to be the first generation to do worse in retirement than its parents, assuming it retires at all. That's our cover story today, Rethinking Retirement, Gen X and Beyond.
I'm Michael Powers, 47 years old. I live in Washoe Valley, Nevada. I'm a carpenter slash cabinet maker slash woodworker, and I think I'll be retiring the day I die.
I'm Catherine Powers. I'm 46. I manage an office suites company, and I guess I'll be retired right after I die.
Michael and Catherine Powers are hardly alone. There is no other way to put this. Middle-aged Americans are in dire straits, with a median net worth of just $15,000. What was once a guaranteed notion of retirement at 65 is as antiquated as your grandmother's silver. The Powers have three children, and like many people of their generation, they didn't even start saving for retirement until well into their 30s.
We did start saving probably only about 15 years ago. I had a profit sharing with the construction company that I used to work for, but that's all gone now.
In 2007, business was booming. The housing bubble kept Michael busy, and the couple was able to save. They'd put away more than $15,000 when the crash came.
When the economy started failing, you know, we lost a whole bunch of the money that we had in, and, you know, we even at one point had to take some out.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was getting really bad there for a while.
2009 was the worst year. After Michael lost his job, they used the small retirement fund for daily living expenses. He says things are better now, but it's still tough to make ends meet.
I was making between $100,000 and $110,000 a year. And then now, last year, we made $30,000. You know, we're not poor. We're very thrifty. You know, we don't buy new things.
Which we would do anyway.
Yeah, which we would do mostly anyway. But there's no retirement. There's, you know, not a lot of extras happening.
Of that 15 grand they'd saved before the recession, only a tiny bit remains.
We have an IRA that has about $500 in it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. That's probably generous. $317 in Facebook stock, to be honest.
Gen X looks to be the first generation that will not exceed the wealth of the group that came before them and to potentially face downward mobility in retirement.
That's Aaron Currier with the Pew Charitable Trusts. Last month, they released a big study comparing the retirement savings of Generation X to previous generations, from baby boomers who are 48 to 65 years old to Gen Xers.
What we did was look at replacement rates, which is how much savings and wealth a person will have to be able to replace their pre-retirement income. Most financial planners recommend being able to replace 70 to 100%. And the typical early boomer has acquired enough savings and wealth to replace between 70 and 80% of their income once they leave the labor market.
So they're right on target.
They're right on target. The typical late boomer will replace about 60%, which is a little bit insecure.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical Gen Xer is only on track to replace 50%.
Well, let's zero in on the Gen Xers. We are, five going on 6 years past the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. How much did that hurt this particular generation?
Well, the Great Recession absolutely took the largest toll on Gen X. They lost the highest percentage of net worth than the other groups, losing an average of $33,000 in their net worth. And they also took the biggest hit to their home equity in terms of percentage loss. So as a group, they definitely got hit. But even before the recession, there were signs that they were not on track to sort of exceed the wealth and the savings of the group that came immediately before them.
Aside from the Great Recession, let's talk about the retirement system itself and where that might be playing into this lack of retirement funding for Gen X. How much of a role does the 401k system play in all this?
That's a great question. What we know from the data is that less than half of Americans have access to a 401k through their employer, and a very small percentage of them try to get retirement plans on their own through an IRA. So for the group that is in the stock market, they've been able to, certainly they took a hit during the recession, but they've also been able to take advantage of some of the recovery that has occurred since. For people who are not engaged in any kind of retirement planning whatsoever, unless some dramatic change happens in terms of their savings rates and their ability to acquire wealth, there is going to be a substantive portion of the Gen X group that will not have a secure retirement.
And that does not bode well for Gen Y and the millennials.
No, it does not.
Erin Currier of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Why is this generation having such a tough time? Well, they took out big loans for college, and wages have not kept up with the cost of living. But they also, for the most part, are doing without a retirement savings vehicle that previous generations had. Michael Powers, for one, misses it.
It's not like, you know, our grandparents had it with, you know, jobs with pensions. And, I mean, for a normal working person, you know, there are no jobs with pensions or insurance.
For most Americans under 50, the savings vehicle they're most likely to use is the 401k. Instead of a company automatically setting aside and managing a pension for you, the 401k allows workers, but does not require them, to invest their own money. Sometimes there's a company match. In theory, it gives you freedom.
Our experiment with the do-it-yourself, individual-directed, commercially provided 401k plan has not worked. It's an abysmal failure in almost every way, and almost all experts agree that something has to change.
Teresa Giller-Ducci studies retirement policy at the New School.
When people were retiring 15 years ago, many of those people who had pensions, and those were middle-class people and up, had defined benefit plans, which gave them a pension for life on top of their Social Security. 5 years later, into the mid-90s, 2000s, and now you're finding people who have a lump of money and their Social Security. And that lump, on average, is about $70,000 for people now just retiring. And they're told that they are supposed to handle that $70,000 for the rest of their lives. And they're also told that they may live until they're 92.
Teresa, if the pension system didn't work because there were promises made that couldn't be kept, companies that essentially did not do what they promised their workers they would do, and now the 401k system is not working because it counts too much on us to be wise and prudent with our money, what kind of system should we have?
What works is to go back to the basics. Make sure that people save where they can save, and that's at the workplace. And you start at the very beginning of your work life and you contribute a little bit. If you start like 5%, if you start saving at 45, you have to save 10 or more percent of your income. If you start at 50, it's not too late, but you have to ratchet down your spending and really ratchet up your savings to almost 25%.
But Teresa, don't we know at this point that people aren't built to save on their own?
Yes, Tess, you're right. People, human beings, cannot be told to withhold their consumption when everyone else around them is consuming, and the place where they would save their money isn't safe. So there has to be new institutions that guarantee a modest but safe continual rate of return. And we can do that by adding to the Social Security system a place where people can save their money and get a rate of return that's safe, maybe 3%. Or states, Tess, are looking into ways that their residents can save money through the public employees' retirement systems in the states. Oregon, Connecticut, Maryland, New York, Washington are all states that are looking into statewide options to the 401k system.
Teresa Giller-Ducci, director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School. For all the efforts in enhancing the retirement system on the state level, most reforms will come too late for people now in their late 30s and 40s. meaning people like Catherine Powers may have to revise their vision for retirement.
We've been married for 26 years. It would be nice just go on road trips together and spend time alone together since we've had a child in the house for over 22 years now.
And missing out on that part of life isn't just bad for the Powers. Analyst Teresa Gellarducci says it's bad for all of us.
This idea of whether or not we are entitled to retirement is a great question. After the Great Depression, there was this idea that everybody deserves some time to themselves to decide what they do with their time. They got the weekend, they got holidays, and they got retirement. And to me, that's one of the most precious periods of our life, because we're going to die after that period, and we need some time to connect to not only the people that we love, but what psychologists call, we need a time to create a personal narrative about what our life meant.
A concept of our golden years that increasingly feels like a mirage.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
Islam is not about converting culture. It's about converting faith and spirituality and understanding. And I can still be American through and through, even if I'm wearing a headscarf and even if I'm dressing in what might appear to be something foreign.
Karen Danielson converted to Islam 3 decades ago when she was just 19 years old. Her experience is not as unusual as it may seem. Some 20% of American Muslims are converts, and they've come into the public eye recently. 2 weeks ago, a Michigan woman and a Muslim convert was killed in fighting in Syria, and the alleged mastermind of the Boston Marathon bombing, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was married to a Muslim convert. Leaving one religion for another can be a complicated process for anyone. But in the United States, converting to Islam can mean making some especially difficult personal choices, at least for some people. And that was the case for Karen Danielson. She was raised Catholic and then later became a Baptist and enrolled in a Baptist college where she picked up the Quran. Karen Danielson is our Sunday conversation.
I had taken a Quran with me because I had chosen my missions to be the Middle East. And I was planning on going to the Arab world.
As a Christian missionary.
As a Christian missionary. And during my free time at the college, my first year, I began reading the Quran. And it struck many chords in my heart. And so I became a Muslim.
When you discovered the Quran and you found inspiration in that book, you could have taken that and left it at that, left it as perhaps a dimension of your own spirituality. Why did you decide you wanted to convert and live a life as a Muslim, which would require changes to how you lived, changes to your culture that you had grown up with?
What made me believe is that I had a prayer. I sat in my dorm by myself and I kneeled on the ground and I picked up the Quran and I said, God, if this is what you want me to follow, it better be easy for me. You know, I can't have any doubt. And I put my head down in prayer and I began crying and I lifted my head up and I felt calm and at peace and cool, and that was my sign. So, and I just moved forward knowing that the Quran was going to be my guide.
What was your family's reaction when you did tell them?
I think the biggest problem was with them didn't really occur until they saw me dressing with the hijab on.
This is the headscarf that Muslims use to cover their heads.
Right. This is when they got very concerned. And when I introduced them to my husband, who is Palestinian, again, they were more concerned. Even at one point, my mom had kicked me out and said, don't ever come back to this home again dressed that way. I never want to see you like this. Mm. But I kept calling her, and I did that because I discovered in Islam that the duty to parents is very important. And then eventually, as the birth of my first son took place, my mom opened up, came into our home.
What were the public perceptions to how you were then living your life? I mean, you had friends, I imagine, a community, and one day you are Karen Danielson, a wayward Catholic who does not wear a headscarf, and then, you know, another day you are a devout Muslim woman who wears hijab.
It was a really difficult time. My closest friend, she tolerated me up until my wedding day and then just didn't show up for my wedding day, which was, you know, a big blow because none of my family members showed up either. So I kept looking at the door, is somebody coming? And then nobody came. That was a difficult thing.
What about public reactions? Did people treat you differently?
I had the gamut of reactions, depending on what was in the news, I guess you could say. So in the 80s, it was like, what are you wearing, you know, and aren't you hot in that? And, you know, you're in America now. You don't have to dress like that anymore. To go home, you sand N-word. Mm-hmm. 9 out of 10 times, I can contain myself. But that 10th time, I had to turn around and respond. Like, where do you want me to go? This is my home. Mm-hmm. There were some scary times as well. I remember after 9/11, I'm from the Bridgeview community here in Chicago in the southwest suburbs. We were under attack. There was a mob forming outside our neighborhood, outside the Moss neighborhood. And the police asked us to stay in our homes, and we couldn't leave because they were marching it was a difficult time. But I did receive some of the most beautiful phone calls. We know you can't go out. Can we go and buy you a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk? What does your family need? A woman drove up into my driveway and opened her trunk, and a total stranger. And her trunk was full of flowers, and she's like, I just want to deliver these flowers to Muslim homes. Could you point some out for me? She gave me a small pallet of flowers, and that was amazing. You know, and that shows how beautiful America actually is. It was what sustained us through those times, knowing that there were people who did not hate us.
Obviously, after the Boston bombings, it emerged that the older of the Tsarnaev brothers, Tamerlan, had married a white Christian woman who then converted to Islam for him. What was your response when you first heard that? Do you just zone out these news headlines?
I just felt totally sorry for this woman because I knew the media was going to have a field day with her, and they did. And it was really sad. And I just pray that God, you know, keeps her patient and strong. I purposely did not follow every news clipping about her. I don't like the stereotype. I don't like to be grouped in that stereotype. I've had people come up to me, say things to me like, you're not supposed to be driving a car. What are you driving a car for? Your religion forbids you to drive a car. And I'm like, what? You don't know what you're talking about. That's the furthest thing from the truth. You don't have any clue. And I have met women who weren't Muslim and they've married a Muslim man and they've ended up converting, but it's a rare bird who just does it for her husband's sake.
We talked a little bit about the resistance that your immediate family and your friends had when you converted. I wonder what the response was from the Muslim community.
They look at American converts as something quite utopian-like and amazing. You know, oh my God, you accepted this religion coming from such a distant cultural background. And so that's why I think converts tend to form support groups, because we really need each other. And so we have to support each other and direct Islam to become part and parcel of the American scene, not just this foreign element in America.
What's your relationship like now with your family?
Both my parents have passed. My father passed over 10 years ago, and he was quite proud of me. And my mother as well was very proud to have me as her daughter and would ask me to read Quran to her and pray for her when she was going through her illness. In regard to my brother and my sister, I have a somewhat cordial relationship with my brother and a very distant relationship with my sister. But there's still hope.
Karen Danielson, she converted to Islam 30 years ago. Karen, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Tony Awards are tonight, and Broadway will be celebrating many of its splashiest new shows. Part of what makes the Razzle Dazzle is all of the costumes, and they require a battalion of workers in a highly choreographed backstage ballet. It's not just to keep the actors looking good, but to help them change outfits almost instantaneously, Jeff London reports.
¶¶ 2.5 hours before the actors and acrobats of the Broadway revival of Pippin take the stage. Deep in the bowels of the Music Box Theater, the costume department is already busy at work. Sewing, washing, hanging up costumes, putting clothes and shoes into baskets. Wardrobe supervisor Megan Carcella says the costumes at Pippin take quite a beating.
They're worn for long periods of time, taken on and taken off, and people are on trapeze in them and sliding down poles and sliding along the floor and getting thrown, so that's the hardest part, is just to try to make them look how they came.
Carcella supervises a team of 17, helping Tony-nominated designer Dominique Lemieux's 90 costumes for Pippin look good. The show about the son of Charlemagne is told by a traveling troupe of circus performers, so Lemieux has created costumes that have a kind of timeless feel.
I add the circus, I add the medieval, I have the contemporain, and you have the acrobatic aspect, you have the musical and the choreographic aspect too. There was many aspects in this show, all blend together.
For Lemieux, who has designed many shows for Cirque du Soleil, there are some tricks to make her costumes both flexible for the acrobatics and durable for the long haul.
I use a lot of lycra. It saved my life very often. If you have a fabric that is not elastic, you can mix some part with lycra, and it will make a pair of pants that look very with ordinary fabric. Mix the lycra in some part, it becomes magic.
Over at the Broadway Theater where Cinderella is playing, there is a lot of costume magic, literally. Twice in the show, Cinderella, played by Tony-nominated actress Laura Osnes, changes from her peasant rags into a beautiful ball gown right in front of the audience's eyes.
Are you involved in her magic?
I'm completely involved in the magic. I am the magic. No, I'm kidding.
The magician is Osnes's dresser, Tammy Kopko, who helps rig William Ivy Long's Tony-nominated costumes and is just off stage to help the actress make her jaw-dropping onstage transformations. At his studio in downtown New York, the designer showed me his costume sketches.
All the changing are done by a magic wand spinning her around. So I tried to include the spinning in all these sketches. So you constantly saw movement. And doesn't that sort of look like you're whipping up a meringue?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I hope that's what it looks like. Looks like it tastes like a meringue, her dress at the ball, doesn't it? All egg whites.
Impossible for a plain yellow pumpkin to become a golden carriage. Impossible.
William Ivy Long has designed 330 separate costumes for Cinderella. Peasant clothes, knights in armor, beautiful ball gowns.
It's a fairy tale. In fact, that's the period, fairy tale.
Impossible.
And he says it all has to be designed to be changed very quickly.
A quick change is 4 seconds. A fast change is like 15 seconds. If you have a whole minute, in the old days, you could smoke 2 cigarettes after you got that under your cuff, because a minute is like glorious. Well, now think about it. You can't get dressed in the morning in a minute, right? So these are professionals. Every ensemble member is a major pro.
There are 30 cast members in Cinderella and 30 people who just work on wardrobe. Dresser Tammy Kopko says during the show, it's kind of organized chaos.
What is choreographed on stage is choreographed backstage, where you shouldn't be, where you should be. You're dodging balls because it's a well-oiled machine. It's quite fascinating when you have 15 people back here just passing right, left, up, down, you know, carrying big dresses, set pieces coming in.
Once the show starts, Kopko is constantly in motion to help Laura Osnes change costumes in the wings. And sometimes she has to improvise and fix things on the fly.
Actually, one of her costumes did come apart, and at the last minute, I was like, oh, my God. And I literally grabbed a hairpin, and I re-rigged it. Literally, when she was running, coming off stage to change, I had it in my hand, and I was like, whew. So you have to be quick on your toes.
Designer William Ivy Long, who's already got 5 Tony Awards on his shelf, loves the whole process of creating and maintaining costumes for Broadway, making polyester look like silk and having a whole chorus change from peasants to noblemen in a minute.
It's fascinating. It's a total science. It's a total art. And altogether, you're not supposed to know any of this that happened. You, the audience member, except you really do.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
If you're curious about all those Tony-nominated costumes and want to see some pictures, go to our website, npr.org.
A symphony of cicadas has been moving up the East Coast, leaving a constant hum in the treetops above and the crackling of carcasses underfoot. Fred Mogul from member station WNYC recently visited the city of Summit, New Jersey. His mission? To check on how the humans there are faring among the insects.
10-year-old Marcus Gokin has mixed feelings about the cicadas scattered around the yards and sidewalks of Summit.
There's just tons of them just squashed, just these flat pancake cicadas that don't look very appetizing.
And yet he's not afraid to touch and handle the unsquashed cicadas to serve a higher purpose.
I did pick up a few and I threw them at some people that I don't like.
What was their reaction?
They screamed a lot.
So success, mission achieved.
Mission achieved.
Marcus's friend, Calla Duffield, wasn't a victim, but she is more in the screaming camp when it comes to cicadas. The other day, she started to take her dog, Rufus, out into the yard, and then thought better of it.
I was out barefoot, and I almost stepped on one, so I ran inside. And I made my brother take the dog out.
Calla and Marcus, and probably most kids from Georgia to Connecticut, have been studying periodic cicadas in school. They can tell you all about Brood 2, as this group is classified. Calla's mom, Hanel Rubin, shares the kids' enthusiasm.
What other creature do you know that goes into hibernation for 17 years and then comes out of the ground just to mate and die?
Down the street, Allison Leba fires up the leaf blower a couple times a day to blow the carcasses off the patio. The cicada's emergence came as a bit of a relief. Before they arrived, her dog Bailey was shaking for days. Leba thought the 12-year-old terrier might be nearing his end. But on the morning they went into the vet, Bailey mysteriously calmed down.
And what it really was, we decided, the vet and I, was that it was the sound of the cicada. She heard it before anyone else could hear it. So she's fine now. She's adjusted to it, and she's happy.
Leba and several other people I talked to said the crimson-eyed critters and their otherworldly din are making them look at time differently.
The cicada routine of every 17 years makes me think of my own mortality. So as much as they're annoying, I think, well, I'm grateful to see them, because God knows if I'll see them again in 17 years.
Certainly, it's pretty unlikely that cicadas will trouble Bailey, the 12-year-old dog, in the year 2030. I just set an electronic reminder to follow up with the Leba family and their friendly, well-tended block of Summit, New Jersey, in 17 years. For NPR News, I'm Fred Mogul.
This is NPR News. It's time for another musical chat with Felix Contreras and Jasmine Garst of NPR Music's Alt Latino. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, good to be back.
Good morning.
You can't get rid of us.
So happy to see you. I don't want to get rid of you. So I understand that you have brought for us today 3 female vocalists.
Well, we both really love all these musicians who are doing things like mixing tradition with electronica and hip-hop and all that stuff. But, you know, we were just thinking that it always comes down to the voice being the most spectacular instrument. So what we did was we found 3 vocalists that we had on our shows recently, has different styles, different approaches, and that's what we're going to do. The first up,
Danai Suarez from Cuba. We kind of feel like she's a legend in the making. They call her the Lauryn Hill of Cuba. This is Siempre Que Llueve, or Whenever It Rains.
Aunque el cielo sea gris y sin una nube blanca, siempre que llueve, escampa entre la espada y la pared.
So she started in rap, and then in 2008 got involved with something called Habana Cultura, which is like a showcase of all the artists in Havana, and she released a wonderful album with Latin jazz and traditional Cuban music and hip-hop, and now she's currently touring the U.S. before going back to Cuba.
Very cool. Okay, Felix, who's up next?
Okay, we have an honest-to-goodness find, like a diamond in the rough, okay?
Really?
One of those kind of singers that you can have bragging rights later on. Says, oh, yeah, I knew her before. Her first album even came out. Raquel Sofia is from Puerto Rico, but she went to a music school in Miami. So she's a trained musician. What she's doing now is she's a backup singer for Juanes, the great Colombian superstar. Yeah. She's in his band. Someone sent me a link to her SoundCloud page, and there are three tracks there, so she doesn't even have an album out yet, and we just were knocked out by it.
Voy a desconectarme, salir y que no me veas más. No voy a dejar una huella, yo voy a perderme por esta ciudad. No quiero que olvides mi nombre, recuerda mi siéntete mal. Que pases toditos tus días en la esperanza de volverme allá. Desataste los hilos de mi vida.
I dig it. She's got good texture in
there. Yeah, absolutely. And what also intrigued us about this song is like, are the lyrics. You know, she's basically like, you know what? You don't even matter to me anymore, dude. You know, I've moved on. You know, and so it's a very strong, independent.
How many times a week do you say that to me?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Well, I like it. I like it. Strong, feminine sound, strong, feminine messages.
And the three tracks on her SoundCloud page are, like, there's a samba, there's a ballad. So there's different aspects to her. I'm really interested to see what she does when she records an album, when she comes off the road with Juanes in the fall.
Okay, Jasmine.
Next up, let's go to Calypso Town. This is Venezuelan singer Sol Ocarina. The song is called Calypso Town.
So if you're going to name the song Calypso Town, I guess you're going to play some Calypso, right?
Sure, and she is from Guyana, Venezuela. She's based in Colombia, and she blends a lot of elements of, well, Venezuelan calypso, indie rock, cumbia, a lot of Caribbean sounds.
And that brings up an interesting conversation we had, because I'm convinced that Venezuela is part of South America and not the Caribbean.
Are you prepared for all the letters from the Venezuelans that you're going to?
It wouldn't even occur to me that Venezuela would be part of the Caribbean.
Yeah, well, I was recently speaking to the lead singer from La Vida Bohème.
A Venezuelan
band, and I asked him about Venezuelan identity, and he told me he feels very Caribbean.
Well, I can understand that relationship with the Caribbean, because Venezuela, Colombia, they both have coasts on the Caribbean, and so that musical influence came in, along with the Pacific side in Colombia with the African influence. All that African diaspora music just gets mixed up in those cultures, along with indigenous cultures, just makes this amazing musical melting pot.
And, I mean, the Caribbean is also a state of mind, right?
It's, sure.
Like, there you go. Like, a little bit of Caribbean
in which I always am.
We're there now.
NPR Out Latino hosts Felix Contreras and Jasmine Garz. Thanks so much, you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Always so much fun.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. 1001 Nights is one of the most enchanting works of world literature. It begins with a king who discovers that his wife is having an affair. In a fit of rage, he has her executed.
And from that night, he decreed a law that he will marry a virgin every single day, deflower her at night, and then kill her at dawn.
This killing continues until Scheherazade, the daughter of the king's closest advisor, offers herself as the king's bride.
She had a plan, a very eloquent and very civilized plan. She wanted to use her art to humanize him and to stop this bloodbath.
That's Lebanese author Hanan Al-Sheikh, and she's published a modern adaptation of 1001 Nights.
She started to tell him every day a story. She will stop at a very crucial moment in the story, and then she will tell him, well, now it's dawn, and I cannot go on telling. It's the time for you to kill me.
Night after night, the king is enraptured by Scheherazade's storytelling, tales of mystery, romance, magic, and deception, until finally the king, now a wiser and kinder man, spares her life, and the women of the kingdom are saved.
I think she was the first feminist on earth.
Scheherazade and her stories have become a touchstone of Arab culture, part of an oral tradition that goes back centuries, put to paper in countless editions, even serialized for the radio. And that is where author Al-Sheikh first heard them as a child.
And I was smitten. But at the same time, I was exasperated because I really wanted her to poison him and finish with that.
You write in your prologue that you wanted desperately to escape the world that this book evoked. Why was that, and what brought you back to this story?
Well, I grew up in Beirut, Lebanon, and all the characters around me, especially women, were very crafty and very intelligent, and they had a way to deal with life. And I thought they are more or less like Scheherazade, while I wanted to become an existentialist like Simone de Beauvoir or Françoise Sagan. And I wanted to be somewhere else than my neighborhood. Hmm. I thought I was more modern than everyone around me.
All these years later, what pulled you back?
The West. When I started publishing, every single review, they would call me the new Scheherazade, the new Scheherazade. And I used to think, oh, it is a cliche. Why do they do that? I don't like Scheherazade. But then I thought, I want to read 1001 Nights and see why am I called Scheherazade. And then one director, he asked me if I'm willing to adapt stories from 1001 Nights for the theater. And of course, this is when I sat and read 6,000 pages. Oh, I read three editions in Arabic.
How did you choose the tales that you did? Because as you mentioned, it's the original work is 2,000 pages.
Yes.
So you had to do some curating. How did you decide what to include in your version?
It was so difficult because every time I read a story, I said, that's it. I'm in love with the story. And then I felt that I was plunging in a sea of jewels and I couldn't really choose very easily. And then the director and I thought that we should find a theme, a plot. And of course, from all these stories, the theme was the women are wily and men were oppressive in a way. So we thought it should be a war between the two sexes.
Mm.
Yes. And I chose stories where women dependent completely on being crafty and manipulative in order to survive.
How were these tales received? I mean, was Scheherazade regaled as a heroine?
No, not at all. All of us, especially Arab women, educated Arab women, would say, no, do you think I am Scheherazade? A slave sitting and telling you stories so you won't kill me? This is how we thought about Scheherazade at the beginning. 1001 Night, Al-Flayla wa Layla, as we call it in Arabic, wasn't looked at as a Arabic literary heritage. People thought it was vulgar. They thought it was very badly written. It is not literature. It's folk tales and nothing else. But then everything changed.
You mentioned the vulgarity. I mean, these tales are very sexually explicit.
They are.
Why are these stories so sexual? They would be compelling stories without it. What is essential about that component?
Yes, because they are down to earth people at that time didn't think that, oh, this is forbidden or we shouldn't be talking about sexuality. They talked about all aspects of life, and one aspect is sexuality. And they left also their imagination to play a big part in thinking about sexuality, because you find jinns and demons and ghosts were all having affairs.
Jinns are genies.
Genies, yeah, you call them genies. And
everybody's having sex.
Yeah. Couldn't believe it when I was reading. I said, and it is so open. And because they didn't camouflage anything. This is what they thought. This is what they said. This is what they wrote.
What is the connection of these stories to Arab society now?
Well, I'd like every single Arab to read 1001 Nights. They learn a lot from them, especially that these stories were written away from the influence of religion. And it's amazing to see how we were open, how we had a dialogue with each other, how we wanted to understand. We respected each other. There was a great dignity, and I'd like this to be restored again.
1001 Nights, as retold by Hanan El-Sheikh. Ms. El-Sheikh, it has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.